From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, a new local organization provides pre- and postnatal support to African-American women.
This is what I want to spend the rest of my life doing, helping women to have experiences like this one.
Hear about a Kansas City businessman who's become a saint to members of one faith. And a new museum in Shawnee is dedicated to the history of medicine.
It was just a matter of finding the right moment, the right building, the right timing in our lives, and this seemed to be it.
Plus, a local blues musician carries on the legacy of her father.
The complete juxtaposition to, you know, a grungy, you know, blues rock star.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. It's widely accepted that breastfeeding is the best way to feed an infant. But in some communities, breastfeeding has fallen out of favor. Nationally, only about 60% of African-American women attempt to nurse their babies. And many of them stop within the first 3 months. But breastfed babies are less likely to succumb to SIDS, asthma, and obesity, health issues that occur most often in African Americans.
One Kansas City group is trying to address infant health disparities, particularly by encouraging breastfeeding in Black communities. Uzazi Village is working to improve birth outcomes through community education and support. To find out more, Casey Currents' Monica Sandretsky paid a visit.
Baby Marcus is a little over a month old. Today he's getting weighed for the second time since he was born. Marcus's mom, Tempest, has been breastfeeding him.
Oh, big baby. It's okay, big baby. You gained a whole pound and 6 ounces, buddy.
Tempest is African American. She's one of the few women she knows in her community who's breastfed beyond her first days in the hospital.
Before I even was pregnant, I was like, when I get pregnant, I want to breastfeed. But, you know, it gets kind of downing when people are like, oh, it's going to hurt, oh, this or that. So it kind of, like, gives you that doubt in the back of your head.
She says it's here at Uzazi Village, not at home, that she's gotten a lot of breastfeeding support.
Coming here, it just boosted back up, like, don't care what nobody else says. You're always going to have a naysayer. Go ahead and do it.
On the corner of 37th and Troost, Uzazi Village is right off the bus line. The weathered delicatessen sign still hangs above the building's wide storefront windows. Inside, the open room is laid with dark refurbished wood, bare brick walls, and a high exposed ceiling. Executive Director Sherry Payne says the place has good karma. She's a nurse and has taught labor and delivery. Payne says it was during her first time breastfeeding that she received a vision for what she wanted to do.
When I was laying there after successfully having that home birth and successfully breastfeeding, I'm sort of in the warm afterglow and holding my newborn, and I thought, and I remember thinking this very clearly, this is what I want to spend the rest of my life doing, helping women to have experiences like this one.
And a year and a half ago, Payne's vision came to fruition. Uzazi is a Swahili word meaning birth, and Uzazi Village is geared specifically to improving birth outcomes for women living in the urban core, especially low-resource African-American women. Sherry Payne says the organization grew out of a community meeting where she posed the question,
if this community could create its own maternity care system, what would that look like?
Based on the community's response to that question, Sherry Payne and three other local women drew up a strategic plan and found the space to open Uzazi Village. Here, families can take the childbirth boot camp class or get advice from the on-staff lactation consultant or get paired with a doula. That's a non-medical person who provides physical and emotional support to a pregnant mom. All of these services are free to women in the community. Right now, Uzazi doesn't offer any medical services. Rather, it's a place for community education and support for issues in pre- and postnatal care. A key part of that is breastfeeding support. Though Payne says most women aren't looking for breastfeeding support when coming to Uzazi.
We haven't breastfed for generations. It didn't just happen overnight.
Kathy Barber is a national breastfeeding advocate. She's written 2 books on economic and social barriers preventing African-American women from breastfeeding. The barriers are multifaceted. Some are institutional. Barbara says she's concerned that healthcare providers are less likely to talk with a Black woman about breastfeeding because they assume she'll use formula. There's also economic barriers. Many of the women at Uzazi work jobs without paid maternity leave and have to go back to work soon after giving birth. And at work, there's often no private space to pump breast milk, so formula seems more convenient. Kathy Barber says there are social hurdles, too.
The Black family right now is not as united as it once was. There's a high divorce rate. And because it was once a very united community, when the Black family started to shift, breastfeeding also started to shift because families weren't together.
And now that fewer Black women are breastfeeding, Barber says many don't have someone serving as a breastfeeding role model.
We don't see our friends breastfeeding. We may not have seen our mothers or our aunties or our grandmothers breastfeeding. So you look at the history, you look at the lack of modeling, you look at the lack of education, the lack of support, and then you get to 2013, all of these factors come together.
That's where Uzazi Village steps in, to try and normalize breastfeeding in the Black community. One way is through mother-to-mother support here at the Chocolate Milk Cafe. It's the only breastfeeding support group in Kansas City that's exclusively for African-American women.
I'm Tempest Brown. Yeah. This is little Marcus. He is a month and a week now.
Alexis, I have a 6.5-year-old and an 11-month-old.
My name's Anika. This is Sage. She is 10 months. No problems with her. Very chubby, chunky girl.
Today, Jamisha Wade is leading a group of four women, and this week's theme is, I've got all my sisters with me.
When I had my first, we were at a Black church in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I didn't have anywhere to nurse, so I nursed on the back steps because I wasn't confident enough to nurse in church, and right. She was kind of a loud baby anyway. So I sat in, like, a stairway, right. Very cramped, right. Hot, right at the top of the church right. To nurse her or nurse in the bathroom. Those are my only options at the church.
Well, but see, I'm that type. I will go ahead and be out there with my stuff, and I did, and you know, if people have something to say, then they have something to say. But when you say preparing to breastfeed, that was in my mind, the preparation of, you know, what am I going to do, how am I going to handle it.
Emotional.
Yep. So that was a big piece for me.
What kind of response, and worried about right. What kind of response you're going to get from others.
Sherry Payne says Uzazi serves women of all races, but at the root, the organization is culture specific. Its purpose is to address maternal health disparities in the urban community, and Payne says that usually means African-American women.
The only Caucasian person in the circle was you, and you were allowed because you're a reporter for today. Notice that there are other Caucasian people here, but they did not join the circle. That is purposeful. We're trying to create a safe space, what I like to call a sacred environment, that is just for them, so that they can nurture one another, they can heal, they can rejuvenate, they can talk safely, speak about all the harm that has been done to them, process it, and take up a healthy attitude, healthy behaviors, and go on.
Part of developing a healthy attitude is seeing images that look like them. Sherry Payne says a lot of literature around breastfeeding and infant care shows pictures of Caucasian babies and women. But she says Black women can't relate to that. So she displays photos of African-American women breastfeeding and plays videos, like this one, called Teach Me How to Breastfeed.
Baby like tea. Can you teach me how to breastfeed? I heard it's free, and all my baby really need. Yo, listen up, grab your partner, and I'll show you how. It's super easy and the best way to feed your child.
Here's national breastfeeding advocate Kathy Barber.
When you have generations of women that haven't breastfed, it's important for them to see images of themselves breastfeeding to say, okay, this actually does happen.
Other organizations in Kansas City have taken notice of Uzazi Village.
Sherry speaking.
In her office at Swope Health Services, Sherry Taheed takes a call while chatting with me at her desk. She's a breastfeeding educator with the government assistance program Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC. Taheed says she meets a lot of women needing maternal health services. She refers them to programs like Healthy Start through Mother and Child Health Coalition or The Birthplace at Truman Medical Center. She tells me that in the last year, she started referring women to Uzazi Village. Even though it's a young organization, Tai tells me that so far, she likes what she sees.
That has been a real flower in the weeds. They're in the heart of the community and really engaging.
Kathy Barber says that despite national initiatives, there's no consensus on how to address the disparities in breastfeeding. But she thinks the answer will blossom from within the African-American community.
The community, the people who are dealing with a particular problem, they already have the solution in hand. They just need help with tweaking it and finessing it to bring it to fruition.
That's what Sherry Payne's trying to do at Uzazi Village. In the next 5 years, the community plans to expand the village by opening a birth center and an urban school of midwifery. For Casey Currents, I'm Monica Sandreski.
Feral hogs are a big, expensive problem. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates the prolific procreators cause $800 million in damages each year to agriculture alone by destroying land and rooting up crops. Some states have successfully wiped out feral swine by taking action early. But as Jacob McClellan reports for Harvest Public Media, states like Missouri with more entrenched populations have shifted their focus from eradication to control.
Three biologists from the Missouri Department of Conservation and I are trudging through the Mingo National Wildlife Refuge in southern Missouri. Our destination is a muddy hole, baited with corn. It's a favorite spot for feral hogs. Conservation agents have been luring them to this spot for a week, and now it's our chance to catch them. We unfurl a net, suspend it over the pig's wallow, and retreat to our blinds, where I get a lesson in Feral Hog 101.
Some of them escaped from hunting farms. Some of them were illegally released for sport hunting. Some of them are turned loose, domestic swine that people don't want anymore.
That's wildlife management biologist Mark McLean. We're sitting in this blind beneath cypress, tupelos, and oaks, waiting for some pigs to take the bait. McLean has been training this sounder, that's the technical name for a herd of wild pigs, for a week to come to this spot. My job is to pull the rope that drops the net. McLean will fire the rifle.
They eat pretty much anything and everything. They scavenge dead animals. They root for grubs and worms. They eat roots of grasses, trees, any roots at all.
That rooting action is what makes them so destructive to ecosystems and to farmers, because they can plow through a field, devouring roots of soybeans or other crops. That's exactly what happened to Michael Tipton on his farm near Caruthersville, a small Mississippi river town deep in Missouri's boot heel.
Somebody came in and released a bunch of domestic hogs and then obviously turned feral on us after that.
Tipton knows somebody released the hogs on his property because they were typical domestic pigs, and they had places where their ear tags had been cut out. They were on his family's land on the banks of the Mississippi River. The hogs reproduced and got into about 6 acres of soybeans last summer, rooting them up and causing about $3,500 in damage.
It looks like the ground's just been turned upside down. That's just torn up. It looks terrible.
He killed some while hunting, trapped some, and the conservation department shot some of them from a helicopter. Now, he says only 3 are left. Missouri's feral hogs are in pockets like that throughout the southern third portion of the state. They've been in the state, though, for a long time, but they really started becoming a problem in the late 80s and early 90s. The state did not immediately tackle the hog problem when it first appeared. Now, some of those pockets are firmly entrenched populations, and total eradication is honestly out of the question. So the conservation department is trying to control those larger pockets and snuff out smaller new pockets ASAP before they turn into a bigger problem.
Any dead hog in Missouri is a good hog, okay? So we don't care how you do it as long as you get it done.
That's the Missouri Department of Conservation's Rex Martinson. The state has a shoot-on-site policy for feral hogs, as long as it's not firearm season for deer or turkey. But hunters are strongly discouraged from going out in the woods specifically to hunt pigs.
The problem with promoting hunting as a good thing is that it stimulates more hunting, which stimulates desire to have hogs in the state, and it kind of tends to perpetuate the species and the population.
Eating feral hogs is discouraged because they host diseases like brucellosis, which can be transferred to humans, and pseudorabies, which cannot. These two diseases can be passed to domestic pigs, according to Dr. Joseph Korn with the Southeastern Cooperative Wildlife Disease Study at the University of Georgia.
The concern is that now we have eradicated these diseases from domestic swine. They're still present in feral swine, then the possibility exists of reintroductions back into our domestic swine populations.
That threat is certainly a concern in Iowa, the top pork-producing state in the country. Iowa, though, is one of the success stories, along with Nebraska. Kevin Baskins is a spokesperson for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. He says small pockets appeared in the southwestern portion of that state about a decade ago. They didn't have a lot, fewer than 100, so his agency took what he calls a patient yet aggressive approach. They trapped as many of the invasive species as they could in a single setting, instead of killing them off one by one.
We got into it as early as we possibly could, and were very effective in getting the few that were out there before they could get established in the wild.
Back in our blind in southern Missouri, we had less success. Hogs' first line of defense is their sense of smell, and four sweaty dudes in swamp blinds for 3.5 hours were more than enough to keep them far away from our net. A couple days later, I got a call from Mark McLean, the wildlife management biologist. They had trapped some hogs in a corral near Piedmont, Missouri, a tiny town in the Ozarks. When I arrived, the hogs were huffing and puffing, rooting up the ground along the fence inside the corral. This illustrates the problem conservation agents are facing here. It takes long hours and a lot of labor-intensive work to catch a couple pigs and ultimately put them down. A lot of work just to keep them in check. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jacob McClelland.
Coming up, a new museum in Shawnee pays tribute to the history of medicine. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Before we continue, we're making some changes to our format and schedule on Casey Currents and want to let you know. We're committed to our mission, getting out there and telling the stories of our diverse communities in Kansas City. But we want to add more opportunities for people to engage with the issues we discuss. Starting next week, Casey Currents will broadcast first on Thursdays at 10 a.m. on Central Standard, and will include a live call-in segment. That show will be rebroadcast Sundays at 5 p.m. and Mondays at 8 p.m. You'll no longer hear us on Monday mornings on Central Standard. We're eager for your feedback as we continue to experiment with our format on Casey Currents over the next couple of months. Feel free to email us at caseycurrents@kcur.org.
Kansas City is the home base for several big religious organizations, like the Church of the Nazarene and the Community of Christ Latter-day Saints Church. But our city can also boast being the hometown of a saint. The Self-Realization Fellowship is an international meditation group with roots in India. And SRF recognizes a late Kansas City business tycoon as one of its greatest yogis and spiritual masters. Alex Smith has the story of a man who's made dollars by day and karma by night. We first broadcast this story in February.
On a recent Sunday morning, about 40 followers gathered for a service of meditation, songs, and readings at the Self-Realization Fellowship's new chapel in South Kansas City. The SRF prefers that services not be recorded or photographed, so we're listening to a recording of the group's religious music. Front and center on the main altar are two pictures, one of Jesus and one of Krishna, representing an ideology that combines Christ's teachings and Hindu yogic practice. The walls of the center are decorated with pictures of the SRF's other important figures, among these portraits of real and mythical saints and gurus with beards and loincloths. One stands out. It features the smiling face of a white Kansas City businessman, the late James J. Lynn.
We've actually had people that have come all the way from India to visit his burial site here in Kansas City. So amongst some devotees in the world of yoga and meditation and SRF, he is considered a modern-day saint.
That's Doug Couch. He and several members of the local Self-Realization Fellowship have been working to uncover the lost history of James J. Lynn. In January of 1932, an ad in the Star announced that an Indian Swami would be speaking for several nights at the Athenaeum in Kansas City. Paramahansa Yogananda's lectures on Indian spirituality had become a nationwide sensation, and on the second night of his Kansas City appearance, millionaire businessman James J. Lynn came to see what the excitement was about. According to Doug Couch, James Lynn later wrote that this evening changed his life.
Yogananda gave brief instructions on how to sit properly for meditation, sit upright and sit very still. And James Lynn said for the first time in his life, he realized that his hands were completely still and that he was sitting completely still. And he thought this was a miracle because he was always fidgeting all the time. And he looked up at the stage and Yogananda was looking right at him. And he could see light all around the stage. And he knew that he'd found his spiritual teacher at that point.
James Lynn made his fortune in insurance as head of both Lumberman's Underwriting Alliance and Universal Underwriters. He also had major interests in oil and citrus fruit. But at age 40, after meeting Yogananda and taking up SRF practice, Lynn's life found a new focus.
Every morning when he would go to work in downtown Kansas City, he would have long periods of meditation in his office, and his secretary was instructed to tell people that he was in conference.
James Lynn became close friends with Paramahansa Yogananda and one of the guru's greatest disciples. The SRF teaches that through meditation, it's possible for a person to attain union with God. While this can typically take several lifetimes, James Lynn seems to have achieved it almost instantly. As member Randy Wolf explains, that's why he's referred to in SRF circles as Saint Lynn.
He became a complete saint in the traditional Indian definition of the term. In India, a saint is held to be someone who has achieved complete union with God. And James Lynn accomplished that in his life. And Yogananda said that his business accomplishments will soon be forgotten, but that his spiritual accomplishments will be remembered for hundreds or thousands of years.
James Lynn started as kind of a weekend warrior, keeping his business and spiritual lives separate. But as he got older, Lynn spent more and more of his time with the SRF and eventually turned his business operations over to nephew Eugene in 1946. When Paramahansa Yogananda died in 1952, James Lynn became head of the Worldwide Religious Organization, though he declined to take over as guru. Doug Couch explains.
It was quite common when a spiritual leader passed that the spiritual title of guru would pass on to his chief disciple. And there were some that were expecting that James Lynn would be the new guru of SRF. And he stated that no, that was not in the will of God at that time, that Yogananda was the last in line of gurus, and that from then on they would promulgate the teachings, the original teachings of Yogananda, and not change them in any way, but try to keep them pure.
When James Lynn died of pneumonia in 1955, both the Kansas City Star and the Times wrote extensive front-page tributes to Lynn, describing his business and philanthropic achievements. He had donated the Epperson House to UMKC and created a scholarship fund for the school. Lynn also donated a substantial addition of land to Swope Park, and he had given $1 million in railroad stock to the SRF. The Self-Realization Fellowship experienced a renaissance in the Aquarian years of the 1960s and 70s and found a new champion in Beatle George Harrison. The current Kansas City group was also born in this era. It was started in 1978 by Donna Marie Vinnie, who's still an active member. Today, the SRF organization incorporates more than 500 temples and centers in more than 50 countries. In these SRF groups throughout the world, James Lynn continues to be revered, despite being more or less forgotten in his hometown.
It really is an example of no matter how successful you are in business, unless you name stuff after yourself, no one's ever heard of it. And he didn't, you know, he was not interested in naming things after himself. So he's probably, you know, in the future, is going to be more widely known as a yogi and as a spiritual figure, and he already is right in this current time.
The Kansas City chapter of the Self-Realization Fellowship opened its first ever center in Kansas City back in November. Members say their new center has been attracting SRF visitors from throughout the Midwest. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
Bye.
Medicine is changing pretty fast these days, with new procedures, treatments, and drugs coming out all of the time. But one area doctor has been out on a mission to pay homage to medicine's past, the mistakes, breakthroughs, and lessons that might be taken for granted today. Dr. Bruce Hodges started out collecting medical relics from around the region as a kind of a hobby, but it's grown way beyond the confines of his house. In February, KCUR's Alana Gordon caught up with Hodges for a preview of his public collection in Shawnee, which hadn't opened yet.
Some people might be really into coins, or stamps, or old records. For Dr. Bruce Hodges, it's all things having to do with medicine.
These are old x-ray machines and ultrasound machines. Here are various medicine bags just for interest. This one is made from a skunk, 1848. They're all kind of unusual. My favorites are the earmuff type hearing devices down there to collect the...
Dr. Hodges has been collecting medical memorabilia for some time.
Oh, I started this 35, 40 years ago when I had a few artifacts that were somehow or other picked up. I don't even remember. And I put them in the waiting room, and people began to say they liked it, and I began to add to it. And first thing you know, I had a pretty large collection.
So how large is your collection?
We have over 5,000 artifacts now.
Dr. Hodges is 80 years old. He graduated from KU Med School in the 60s and has been practicing in the region ever since. His focus is primary care, but he moved into geriatric medicine as his patients got older. Initially, his family thought his collection was just an expensive hobby.
And then, first thing you know, it had such a collection that it began to have meaning.
Hodges says about 10 years ago, he and his family reached a turning point. He'd been displaying some of the items around town, but the collection had gotten really big. Too big. They reached a point, either sell everything or go all out.
This is a new museum which is being developed, Medicine's Hall of Fame and Museum in Shawnee, Kansas.
Hodges and his family have put everything, their life savings, into vamping up this collection. They've spent the last several months preparing to open up this museum. Hodges says it's been a dream of his for over a decade.
It was just a matter of finding the right moment, the right building, the right timing in our lives, and this seemed to be it.
What is this space? What did it used to be? It seems kind of like it's got some kind of old, like, 70s feel, a lot of wooded paneling, like it might have been, you know, an old lodge restaurant.
Actually, this was an old motorcycle showroom, a Harley-Davidson, and this actually was the showroom for the motorcycles, and back the next section was the parts department, and then there was the workshop behind that. The building is 15,000 square feet.
The whole place is loosely organized through medical themes that Hodges has parsed out by region and time. There's a Native American section that features things like a healing drum used by a secret society of the Chippewa tribe in the late 1800s. There's an entire display just focused on smallpox,
which was still very deadly, even in the United States in the 60s. When we had 60 and 70,000 cases of it, and 80% of those people died. But when immunizations came along and people got vaccinated or they got shots for typhoid fever, we began to wipe those diseases out. And smallpox is a perfect example of how diseases can be eradicated, not just in the United States, but from the face of the earth.
Turn on the light.
Let's start in here.
Hodges takes me to a separate room where he has two of his most valued items, iron lungs.
This is like a chamber, and it's about 2 feet, 2.5 feet in diameter. It's about 6.5 feet long.
The antiquated respirators helped keep paralyzed polio patients alive and breathing in the 1950s. This iron lung is a soft yellow color. There's a mannequin in it.
The pressure would be built up by this machine, and as the pressure increased inside of the tube, it would press on the chest and force you to breathe out, exhale. Then it would create a vacuum and lift the chest. And it did that 18 times a minute. The average life expectancy in here was 9 years.
9 years.
Mm-hmm.
So do you remember seeing people in these when you went to the hospital?
Yes. When I was a teenager, I was hospitalized at General Hospital in Kansas City, and they had many of these units, a whole ward full of them.
Hodges says polio vaccines, which he used to administer, have mostly gotten rid of the disease. And it's artifacts like this iron lung that he says bring to life medicine's past and significant developments. There's one other part of the museum that Hodges says brings all these themes together.
Another room. Oh, there's another room.
You can see we're still developing. This is going to be what we call a Hall of Fame.
This space will entirely be devoted to people who've contributed to medicine over the years. People like Ignaz Semmelweis, who proved the importance of washing hands in the 1850s.
Hand washing is the one thing in medicine that prevents disease more than anything else. The one thing. Dr. Semmelweis initiated a policy in the hospital that all the doctors had to wash their hands before they went in to deliver a baby. They almost kicked him out of the hospital. But when the doctors were made to wash their hands, the death rate also dropped from 33% to 3% on the doctor's ward.
Also featured is Christian Barnard, who did the first heart transplant. And then there's Sir Alexander Fleming, who invented penicillin. Hodges said without him, he wouldn't be here today. As a kid, Hodges came down with what would have been a fatal illness. But luckily for him, he says he was one of the first patients to gain access to penicillin. Hodges hopes the importance of these and other developments will come to life through his collection once the museum opens, and that others will come to appreciate the history of medicine as much as he does. Reporting for Casey Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
Dr. Bruce Hodges Medicine Museum and Hall of Fame opened earlier this year in Shawnee. You can test how well your own medical trivia knowledge matches that of Dr. Hodges in a quiz online at kcur.org. You can also check out some photos of that iron lung and other artifacts on display at the museum.
When you think of a dairy farm, you're probably envisioning black and white cows dotting a rolling hillside. But there are countless deviations of that pastoral setting. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon recently paid a visit to one of the more interesting dairy operations in the country. He takes us to a water buffalo dairy that's behind razor wire fences in southern Colorado.
Welcome to the 4 Mile Correctional Center outside Canyon City, Colorado, an unlikely place to find what could very well be the country's largest herd of domesticated water buffalo.
I believe we have right at probably 250 head. You want to go look at them first?
Steve Smith runs Colorado Correctional Industries, a division of the state's Department of Corrections that sets up businesses within prison walls, and today he's my tour guide. Cheesemakers sometimes blend in buffalo milk to give their cheeses a distinctive taste, and the herd at the prison in Canyon City is really the only place to go for a big quantity of buffalo milk in the U.S.
People say, how do you milk a water buffalo? Very carefully.
It feels like any other farm, just run by prisoners in green jumpsuits. The sprawling campus stretches along the upper Arkansas River. Warning signs are everywhere within the prison gates, but the one at the water buffalo pen had to be custom made. It reads, "Warning, water buffalo are very dangerous animals."
We get a lot of looky-loos down there, and so we want them to stay away from the animals.
The horned beasts poke their heads between the white metal fence as we drive by. If you squint, you might mistake them for beef cattle, but their curled horns give them away. These are water buffalo. The prison already has goat and cow dairy operations, so why the addition of these animals?
We had an opportunity that a customer lost their ability to get water buffalo milk from India. When I found out about it, we did a business plan.
That customer is Leprino Foods, arguably the world's largest mozzarella cheese manufacturer. If you've eaten a pizza recently, there's a good chance the cheese came from Leprino. When the company lost its supply, Smith was happy to step in and offer up rich, frothy buffalo milk. Leprino wouldn't do a taped interview for this story, but a spokesman says the company uses the milk as an addition to their cheese to give certain products a unique taste. The milk is more fatty than a dairy cow's.
We'll go up here to the parlor.
On a raised concrete platform, half a dozen water buffalo stand in small pens, prisoners in reflective vests affix tubes to the animal's udders.
You could probably touch one if you want.
Prisoner Feliciano Gomez oversees the water buffalo operation. Most businesses within the prison's walls are run by inmates.
Yeah, they got the attitude, they got their own personalities.
Personalities that can sometimes be confrontational. Gomez says most prisoners who work with the buffalo have stories of being horned by the temperamental animals, with the bruises to prove it. He started working at the dairy almost 2 years ago. Prisoners who work at the dairy earn $5 a day, with the chance to earn even more for how much milk they produce. Smith says most men are sending the money to family outside the prison or to court-mandated child support.
Never in my life would I think, you know, I'd come to prison and milk water buffalo. Never in a million years.
The prisoners have to apply for jobs. No one's forcing them to work. Critics have pointed to the fact that this is cheap labor for for-profit companies. But the important thing for Smith is these jobs give the men marketable skills for when they're released.
97% of all inmates are getting out. They're hitting the streets. So what do you want when that guy comes in and moves next to you? Do you want him to be able to have a job and keep a job? Or do you want him to go out and do the same habits he did when he came in?
A Colorado Corrections Department study showed if prisoners spent the last 9 months of their incarceration working, they had a 19% better chance of not reoffending. Sometimes it works a little too well. Smith says one prisoner got out, started a business, and ended up stealing away clients from the prison, though they still have control of water buffalo milk. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
After the break, local blues musician Cassie Taylor. This is Casey Kearns. This is Casey Kearns. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
For the past decade, blues singer and bassist Cassie Taylor has made her home on the road. At age 16, she started touring with her father, bluesman Otis Taylor, and she started her own solo career a few years after that. While Taylor has no plans to slow down, the 26-year-old veteran is settling down a bit. She recently got married and moved to Kansas City. Some of the true life stories of the blues life and love lost and found are the subjects of her latest CD called Out of My Mind. Taylor recently talked to Susan about her life and music. She explained how her career began by eavesdropping on her father's band practice.
I walked in on my dad playing Hey Joe, and I was really interested in the bass line that his bass player was jamming with them. And so I asked to learn it, and they taught it to me really quick, and I kind of played it back to him. And I think that my dad knew at that point that I had the capabilities of picking up the bass, and it wasn't until I was 16 when his bass player actually couldn't go on the tour. And so my dad was kind of like scrambling around and, you know, didn't know quite what to do. And so he just came to me and he was like, okay, I'm going to teach you how to play bass and you're going to come out on the road with me. And I was like, cool, I guess. How much do I make? And he was like, $20. And I was like, sweet, that can like take me out to the movies and buy me sushi. So I went with him, and it was really, it was just such an interesting experience being that age, submerged into a really adult world. And I thank God for it, because I was like the biggest loser in high school, and I really couldn't relate to kids my age just because I was a little bit different, and an adult world was exactly what I needed to gain the confidence.
So what did you learn, and what advice did your dad give you about touring and that sort of thing that still sticks with you?
Well, my dad told me that I should write my own songs because that was where all the money is. And so that was something that I really have kept true. And I try to do as many, you know, self-written songs as I can, especially because I was diagnosed with dyslexia when I was in the third grade. And I think that it's a wonderful way that I can be an author, but not have to subscribe to the rules of literature, like punctuation and spelling, and you can still get across really amazing images and phrases and emotions, but without all of the context that, you know, writing on paper has. Somewhere off Bourbon, some seek sex, some seek love. But when you turn the corner, something wicked this way comes. Holy brave down to enter the alleys, damp and dark. Fish bones in the garbage, and it smells like broken hearts.
So have you faced any special challenges being a female artist? I mean, some would say, you know, the playing field is more level now, but some others say not.
Absolutely is not level. And I recently spoke with a promoter after the show to get paid, and his response was, "I don't do business with women." And
was he serious?
He was absolutely dead serious. And it's one of those things where, you know, you're always aware of it, and then some days it will just smack you right in the head. And I've had, you know, sound guys come up to me and just assume that I have absolutely no idea what's going on, and that I don't understand what I want my tone to be, because how could I? I'm a woman. And I think that there's that difficulty to it. And then I think that there's also an underlying sexuality that audience members expect you to participate in. Whereas it's, if you're a woman, especially in the blues world, you are asked to appear a certain way. And that happened. I went to a show, and the buyer then later complained to my agent that I didn't dress up enough. I'm a woman. I should want to look good on stage. For me, looking good on stage is just to commit to a style and to be who I am, not to put on a short, tight dress and wear some sparkly heels. You know, I think that that's a secondary sexism in the music industry. It's like we're not expected to operate the same or be as bright in the music industry. And then there's this expectation to where if you're going to be a female musician, you have to look sexy. And to me, sexy isn't the clothes that I wear. It's more of the feeling that I give off. And sexy can be slutty, and it can also be powerful. And for me, I would rather go with the longevity of a powerful sexuality rather than the quick sale of a slutty one.
So how do you deal with some of those things?
I just keep going. Mm-hmm. I think the best thing to do to combat it is just to not give up. Because eventually, if you put time and effort to it, people will realize kind of the message that you want to convey.
Now, at one point, you did get kind of disillusioned and took a break, right?
Absolutely.
Now, what led you to take a break?
It was, you know, the kind of cheap and tawdry images that were coming out of the music industry. And I just didn't want to be a part of it, because I wanted to be about the music and the songwriting. And that's just not what it was. And I was told, you know, that I wasn't going to get a record deal unless I lost 20 pounds. And I was just like, why? Why is that something that's important to the music that is going to make somebody feel something? And so I just left, and then it kind of found me again through more of the blues. And I think that the blues is definitely more of a forgiving genre as far as looks. It's less lookist, but it goes back to that whole sex thing where it's like you have to be very particular about the image that you want to deliver to people.
I'm Susan Wilson, and today I'm talking with Cassie Taylor about her new CD project, Out of My Mind. Things about Cassie that people wouldn't know just by looking at her?
I love being at home. And that's something I've always loved. I'm a big proprietor of daily dinners cooked for my husband and for friends. And I love to bake, and I love to decorate and garden. And I have a zest for all things vintage. And so it's interesting. It's like the complete juxtaposition to, you know, a grungy, you know, blues rock star is to have this little, like, you know, vintage apron, like completely like manicured woman with dinner on the table by 6 o'clock every night. It's like completely different, but it's like, I guess, my alter ego.
Where do you think that came from?
I think it came from all the old movies that I watched when I was really young. I loved, like, just like White Christmas, I guess, is the first one that my mom played for me when I was little, and just the glamour and the clothing and the A-line dresses and the hair, the makeup and the long red nails, and just like the sweeping ball gowns that skim the hardwood floors. I just think that that's a time in American history that is just so beautifully put together. And even though that was a really turbulent time in history, just the way that they captured it in the cinema is just so classic.
Now we'll cue up the song, That's My Man. Listen to it, it's clear you're talking about a good man and a bad man. Are they one person or two experiences as you wrote the song?
Three experiences, actually. There's the good man, and then the man that drinks, and then the man that beats. And I wanted to kind of show that the man who was good because there was a reference point. There were things in the past that led you to this current experience, but that you wouldn't be able to appreciate that man had you not had those bad experiences.
Now, what inspired that song?
My life. And I think that, you know, through my life, the partner that I'm with right now is so great because I've had all of these different experiences. I think that, you know, you date to mate to find the one that you want to be with, and all of the ones that came before are the reference point for how wonderful that is. And, you know, I took things from those relationships that I knew I did not want ever to see in a partner, and really lovely things from each person that I said, you know, that is a fantastic and endearing quality, and I want to see that in the partner that I do end up with, so...
So, Cassie, you also have a warning song for women who are thinking about shacking up. The No Ring Blues. Let's listen to a bit of it.
I cook your meals. I wash your clothes. I kiss your neck. I rub your toes.
Gave you the idea for this song?
Oh, God. Oh, I'm going to get in trouble. I wrote this because I wanted to get married. And my boyfriend at the time came in and he said, you know, why don't you write me a song? I was like, you know, I was just feeling a little feisty. And so I was jokingly writing this song, and it ended up to be actually, I think, one of the better songs on the album, just because it's a little bit sarcastic and it's a little cheeky, and And it, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, if you are a woman and you want to get married with the partner that you are with, by all means, you should make that happen. And if they don't go along with it, then that's not the man that you should spend, you know, 6 years. And at the time that I wrote this, I had a friend who wanted to get married, and she had been with her partner for 6 years. And I think that that kind of was weighing heavy on me, because I knew that they would never get married. She would never get what she wanted, and they ended up ultimately breaking up.
So I'm dying to know, but you don't have to tell me if you don't want to. Did you end up marrying him or moving on?
I ended up marrying him. I made him my manager, and we now live on a little cabin in a lake in Kansas City.
So. And he happens to be sitting here in the studio.
I know, and
with
that's
us.
Why I'm so embarrassed. I know I'll hear about it once we get in the car.
Well, it sounds like you made the right choice.
Yeah, he's a fantastic human being. He's absolutely bright red now, too.
Well, Cassie Taylor, I want to thank you for coming in the driving rain to be with us here on KC Currents today.
I'm a little cold and wet, but it's all right.
Thanks for sharing with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Cassie Taylor's latest CD is called Out of My Mind. We're going out on a track from that album called No No. Her next local show is September 14th in Lawrence. We first aired this interview back in June.
Woke up this morning.
We appreciate you tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
And tune in Thursday morning at 10 for the next broadcast of KC Currents. We're playing with our format. We'll now be repeating Thursday's show on Sundays at 5 and Mondays at 8. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our intern is Monica Sandretsky, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
'Cause why would you stop?